Good morning, everybody. We're going to start our final day of deliberations with the disclosure initiative. Christy.
So we're going to today discuss agenda papers 11A and 11B, and these are on the drafting of disclosure requirements, and that will be a chapter in the principles of disclosure discussion paper. I'll hand over to Kimberly Crook from the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board. They've been leading the development of this proposal and developed these papers. So I'll pass over to Kimberly.
Okay, and you recall from the last time that you saw this, which was back in April, the approach that we're looking at here is we've got three key aspects to it in terms of how to draft disclosure requirements and standards. The first being around more emphasis on objectives for both the overall objective for the standard and then specific objectives for each set of disclosures. Greater emphasis on the exercise of judgment, and then a two-tiered approach to disclosure requirements, which I'll come back to in a moment. At the last board meeting, I think the board was broadly supportive of the approach but did have concerns, particularly around language. You might recall a discussion around, at the moment we're trying to address with disclosure requirements being very prescriptive, which leads down that compliance checklist approach. And what we presented to you last time, I think, was the opposite extreme, which was highly principled. And there was a question about had that pendulum swung too far, and we needed to find a happy medium between the two. We've since then presented that work at the ISB workshop held in Tokyo, at which there were a number of standard setters from the Asia-Oceania region, which also looked at it and have, I think, broadly similar reactions as the board. And we spent quite a bit of time particularly talking about the wording, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Since then, we've also reached out and had some, just the staff have had some discussions with the firms, both at the international level and also locally within New Zealand. The work's also going to the World Standards Centres next week to get the feedback from them. So I think the overall feedback today has been supportive of the overall approach. On the objectives part of the approach, people are supportive of the idea of having objectives. They think that's helpful. One feedback we have had is around the overall objective for each standard, and that's still at a pretty broad level. It's based on the conceptual framework, and the feedback has been, can we think about making that a little bit more tailored and specific to the topic? So that's something we'll have a look at. And people are also supportive of the wording that we've now got for the two tiers. What we've got there in the first tier is essentially, I guess you can call it a minimum set of disclosures. We don't use that word minimum, of course. But it's really a group of general or overall disclosures that all entities would be required to provide, subject only to materiality. So that's to give you greater consistency and comparability across entities. And then for the more specific additional disclosures, there is more room to exercise judgment, but the wording is intended to convey the idea that entities are required to assess whether or not they need to provide those additional disclosures, because there was concern previously that it might be interpreted as a free choice that you could just do whatever you wanted to do. And so the idea of using the words shall consider was intended to convey the message that entities do indeed need to go through a process of considering what information they need to provide in order to meet the disclosure objective. So that's probably enough from me by way of introduction. Really over to you, and the key question today is to get your feedback on where you think it's going. Obviously, welcome any suggestions for refinement. Overall, looking for a direction from the board that you're comfortable that, subject to those refinements, that this material is suitable to be included in the discussion paper to be published early next year. Thank you.
This question about the consequence of the wording change, where you propose to tighten the wording, replacing an entity considers disclosing with an entity shall consider whether to disclose. I'm not sure that in French it makes a big difference, but does that imply that there is a documentation requirement attached to that shall consider? Because if we make it tighter, an entity has to be able to demonstrate that it has considered. So does that imply some auditing and governance requirements, except that you must document that you have considered, and how can one document these kind of things?
Yeah, that was a question actually that came up at the Tokyo workshop around, and I guess people were thinking about hedging, for example, where there are requirements around documentation, and should you have that requirement in the standard? Others thought perhaps it's more of an audit issue, and that perhaps we need at some stage need to be consulting with people from an audit perspective to understand whether it's actually needed to document. They certainly will need a rationale, so that when auditors or regulators, for example, are asking, well, what did you do when you thought about this? What sort of process did you have? What did you consider? And how did you reach your your decisions? They would need to have an answer to that question. I guess there is a question about how prescriptive we want to be in the accounting standard about what documentation you might need, or whether that's more in the audit space.
Doc?
Thank you. Thank you very much for the papers. And also, we discussed it in the Asia Oceania office more than 2 hours. And the discussion itself was very good because it was not open to public. Therefore, we are.
It was a lot better.
in a sense. Because we had a very candid discussion. And the discussion was concentrated on the behavior of preparer and auditors. Currently, we have kind of checklist approach. And maybe the checklist approach is good for the auditors and regulators to prove that they have done everything. But it wouldn't necessarily provide useful information effectively. Therefore, in order to achieve the effective disclosure, that behavioral change is essential. That is what we discussed, if my recollection is correct. Then how can we address such kind of behavioral change? That is maybe the use of judgment. To emphasize the use of judgment is very effective. So then you incorporated and emphasized the use of judgment. However, one obstacle is the relation between regulators. So regulator has to penalize if something wrong happens. And then look at the financial statement, and if that fact was not disclosed, then that company may be penalized, or auditor may be penalized. But they made a judgment that was not material at some point, but today it is very material. So it was not material 10 years ago, but it grew over time. So now it became all of a sudden very material, but they didn't disclose it. So then regulator would penalize that company. Such kind of things happens. And therefore, it's very difficult for the preparers to exercise judgment whether it is not material or immaterial. So such kind of judgment is difficult. Therefore, preparer tend to avoid having such judgment. That is the problem, and how we can address it. And then your draft on page 7, which is the agenda paper 11B, 739, on the page 7, talks about it, and use of judgment. And then entity has to decide more information in relation to transaction item that are particular importance to them, but less information in relation to transaction item and are relatively less important, and no information about transaction and items that are immaterial. Such kind of judgment has to be made. And based on that judgment, in each year, entity has made a judgment. So such kind of protection is necessary for the preparers and the auditors. I don't know this wording would help auditor or preparers, but I think we have to discuss this part more so that we can change the behavior of preparers and auditors.
Jungu.
Thank you. I agree with the tax point on this judgment, so basically, but I like suggested two minor maybe amendments of your nice paper that are recommended here. Everything is so impressive. However, one thing is, how about there are some reducing the emphasis of a use of judgment. Maybe judgment, we have to exercise judgment to meet our objective, but based on your example in Appendix A, for example, IAS 16, you know, the first paragraph disclosure objective, just one short paragraph, the next three paragraphs on the need for judgment. So it seems to me, you know, relatively, you know, maybe it looks like judgment is important, but too much emphasis. So I think if you just look at those three paragraphs on this need for judgment, maybe first or second paragraph might not be necessary. Maybe the last paragraph might be enough to emphasize appropriately to remind the preparers to think, you know, judgment is very important. Now, that's a behavioral thing, is another big issue in many jurisdictions. You know, judgment, you can do that, but how can regulate them or how to audit them is a really big issue, is headache for the jurisdictions. So as you changed your direction, you know, a little more formal expression, you know, to give a kind of things, that's good direction, but still need to, you know, balance this one. Another thing you think about before including this one into our discussion paper is the relative balance of the summary information and additional information. Based on your the same example that IS 16 summary, if you see summary information, you just listed some kind of titles of the important topics of the note disclosure. This is a kind of a required summary disclosure. After that, additional information is a kind of voluntary. If this additional information you think necessary, then provide this information. But based on your recommendation, on this additional information, there are so many paragraphs, so many details in this requirement. If you see the titles of these five topics, they are very important. Actually, that's a repeating the summary note disclosure in the above. So I'm saying, you know, maybe a little. This is very nice, but too much emphasis on additional information. That's voluntary, but rather we should focus on more if we, the required note disclosure on summary information. So those two might improvements maybe you must think about.
It's a very good document, as I would expect. I like the way that you've written it, and I like the way that you've changed the wording to shall consider whether to disclose. My only suggestion, and I know that your drafting is extremely elegant and you've already tried to cover it, I'm looking at the Appendix A, you've already tried to cover it in the way that you drafted A8. But I think while people get used to this, it might be good to sort of have belt and braces, and perhaps wherever we say an entity shall consider whether to disclose whatever, we should say in order to meet their disclosure objective, so they remember what the basis is for what they consider, you know, what they should be aiming for when they're making that consideration. Maybe that would help. The only other thing I wanted to talk about was what our sort of process is, because as you know, I've always been worried what the consequences are of these words, even though we all think they sound like a great idea while we sit here talking about them. And what struck me in meetings I've been in recently is both when I was in Australia talking to National Australia Bank, actually, in a public meeting about applying IFRS 9, they talked about how difficult they'd found it to apply the disclosure requirements, which we've tried to draft in a more objective-based way. And they intimated that had made it more difficult for them to work out what to disclose. And last week I was in a conference in Berlin where people were talking about the new revenue requirements, and again somebody was talking about how difficult preparers were finding it to work out what to disclose, where we'd move to a more objective-based set of disclosure requirements. And I think we'd originally talked about the potential of asking people whether they thought they could work with the words in these documents,
I wonder whether we should supplement that with talking to some of the people who are actually live trying to use these words we've used in some of the recent standards, where they're really sitting down and actually going through the work as opposed to a theoretical exercise. And it might be because we just didn't draft them as well as you have in here, and that's interesting information. But I also hear from people that if you don't have a big team of people who are sort of very experienced accountants, making the judgments is quite difficult. And some people have said they're finding it quite hard to put themselves in the shoes of users to work out what they think should be provided. So while people have criticised a checklist, I think they're finding that maybe it was quite an easy thing to follow as well.
Yeah.
And I think some of that live feedback might be helpful for us to work out whether it's going to work very well in application or not.
Can I just say in response to that, one of the things we are thinking about doing with this, and we've already arranged for a couple of companies to do it, is actually field test, to have a go at, you know, sit down and think about, if you had to comply with this today, what would you do? And expanding that. At the moment, we've picked a couple of companies and asked them to look at property, plant and equipment, one of whom is a financial institution for whom property, plant and equipment is not terribly interesting, and the other is an infrastructural company for whom it's incredibly important. So we thought that would give us a nice contrast to see how it's going. But perhaps you think we need to do more of that kind of thing as well.
Maybe expand it to
expand a few more
to standard, to actually look at the way we've worded our current standards, maybe sort of compare it against what we're
proposing.
Might just
be we didn't do a good job, but I think some of it is the change. Maybe it's just change management, but I think it could be an interesting source of information.
Yeah. Okay.
Gary.
Yeah. Thank you. And echoing some other comments, I thought it was a very, very good paper, covered a lot of ground, you know, quite crisply and clearly, and so on. It. I'd like to suggest, whether it's this paper or some other part of the principal disclosure project, I think we need to go back to emphasizing disclosure depends on relative importance, perhaps a little bit more than we're giving it. And the reason why, and which I guess judgment would come along with that as well, and the reason why I'm saying that, I absolutely agree we should have disclosure objectives in every standard. But this paper and all the other work we've done in there, when we've had examples of disclosure objectives, the common themes seem to be base of accounting, information about what's in the primary statements, risks and uncertainties, and be able to assess future cash flows. That doesn't eliminate much. I mean, that is what footnotes are about, have traditionally been about, and I think maybe we can take it back into the small group meetings and, you know, the staff work about if those are the disclosure objectives, standard by standard, that eliminates nothing of what we've been doing now. And is there a way to get more focused subject by subject in terms of principles? I think, I'm not sure you can. I think that's what sort of brings us back to disclosures depend on relative importance would be the way to finish up it. The classic objectives we're using doesn't eliminate anything. I mean, it would just almost become boilerplate, and I think we need to, think a little bit deeper about how you apply it in given subjects.
Mary?
Several points, again, compliments, because two papers sparked a lot of ideas in reactions. One is, in terms of the discussion about the use of judgment, and I think this is something, I don't know if it's Tucker or Chung Wu said, what you have in either paragraph 19 or then when you look at the examples, I think would be virtually the same wording for every standard. And it reminds me of the boilerplate that, you know, that we are trying to get people to eliminate. But I think it's a good discussion. And so my sense is that would be better somewhere in, let's say, IS1 or, you know, a next generation. And then within a standard, we would say something like, to achieve this objective, an entity shall use its judgment as discussed in. So there's an explicit cross-reference to that, but we don't have to have the standard wording in each standard in terms of warming up to say what we think the disclosure objectives are. Now, second thing is, When you look, for example, at paragraph A9, I was trying to think about the wording you shall, you know, you consider, and what does that require you to do? And my, although I usually am very campaigning against any reference of materiality in an individual standard because of the concern about multiple layers of materiality, I was wondering whether we could adopt language kind of along the lines of an entity shall consider what additional information is material about the basis, or, you know, what basically what we're saying when you're considering, and I think this might fit with the point, was it Sue was saying, in order to meet the disclosure objectives, but saying when you're considering, your objective is to determine what additional information would be material. I think it's a third comment, that's another aspect of what Gary was saying. If we could make it more explicit when we're talking about the judgment, that especially, let's say, paragraph 26, 27, that importance is a function of both quantum and qualitative, you know, how it's used in operations, for example, because I think we can have something, we keep talking about PP&E, something that is large but may not be so significant because it's very stable, and so making the point that it's both. And then last, in terms of Sue's observation about people struggling more than we might have expected with 9 and 15, I hear that, and I think that it would be good to check with them, but I also think that if we test with PP&E, people probably have a pretty good idea of what they should be disclosing, and you know, because practice is established, they know what questions they get, where things are, and so they kind of need something to force them to pivot in terms of what they're disclosing. But with something like IFRS 9, which is newer, IFRS 15, I think there is uncertainty about exactly what information is going to be material, and so I would expect it to be a lot harder to figure out, especially in year one, what you need to do. Doesn't mean I don't want to give any help, and I think we should check whether we've drafted it clearly enough, but I would expect most, you know, just figuring out what users really care about to take a couple of years to really settle down and tune.
Martin?
Sorry.
Yeah,
I just want to ask a check one question for Mary, that first point around the placement about the use of judgment. I mean, we have tried to avoid getting into location where things better sit, and that's why it's in both standards, although we've acknowledged, I think, that perhaps it does better sit in IS1. But given that feedback, and I think other people have had a similar reaction, do you think, even for the purposes of illustrating it, it would be better to have to say, be up front, at the moment we're envisaging this is probably going to go into a general standard like IS1, just to sort of stop people going down that track?
I think so, and I mean, I think you get into the details, you could display it by saying, you know, here's the kind of material we'd expect to put in one place, and then here's what we'd have in standard. I would still show it to them.
Martin?
Yeah, and I think I agree with the changes to the approach, but I have some really doubts if it really in practice would work. And two reasons for that. First is, okay, I think to really exercise more judgment in disclosure, really need really disclosure objectives more detailed in the standards. Mm-hmm. But I will question if we're really able to do that, because, man, if we currently also in the newer standard, we have also this overall disclosure objective of forecasting cash flows, but I think that is really not helpful for a preparer to doing that. And I tried also for a standard to look, what is this objective? It is really, really difficult. And I think it depends on really, are we able to give in more detail what the disclosure objective of each standard and disclosure requirement is? And as I said, I have some doubts to doing that. Secondly, okay, to exercise more judgment, I think that is really difficult, man. If you prepare really financial statements, year-end financial statements in a report, and you have to require all your kind of legal entities, consolidated entities, to provide you with the information. So I think that will not help the preparers, okay, to save cost in disclosure, and that is what many are requiring. They say it's an overload of disclosure, and that leads to additional cost. But I think if you have you shall disclose, you have at first make a judgment, you have to have this information. So you have all your reporting system, you must contain this information. And then in the group, maybe you receive this entity, this kind of information 3 weeks after year end, and then you have to publish the reports maybe 5-6 weeks after year end. And do you think you have kind of judgment to think at each and kind of disclosure, is it material, yes or no? And I think then with the kind of current environment, and people told me always in financial statements is a legal document. And we think it's a communication tool. Yeah, maybe both. But for many, it is also a legal document. And if you have doubt, really, if it is material, yes or no, and maybe as Tuck said, maybe 10 years later, you have to justify with in court or with regulators or auditors, okay, why have you made your judgment? Better you document your judgment. And if you have to document all this kind of judgment, is it material, yes or no? I think in this short time frame where you have to prepare your financial statement is not possible. And I really think this approach maybe is a little bit helpful, but I think as long as we don't go to the standards and say, okay, can we really restructure the disclosure requirements, it will not help a lot. So this is my personal view. Because, and also yesterday from the FASB, I think their approach is going more and more to the standards and trying to restructure really the disclosure requirements. Because otherwise, we said it's behavioral stuff, but I don't think really that will change behavior a lot. Because practically, it is very, very difficult to do this. And you don't have in a company, when you look at how many disclosure requirements do you have? 1,000? And who will do all these judgments? The chief accountant officer? And he cannot, you cannot delegate this kind of stuff. You have to do it by your own or the CFO. And therefore, I think it's very, very difficult.
I guess you have a point.
Martin, when you say restructure the disclosure requirements, are you really meaning going through and cutting
out?
Cut, or maybe, as I said, man, I think we should at least try. We're always saying here now, disclosure objective, but we have never, I mean, we have tried it for some, I think, with but really go through it. Are we able to come to more detailed disclosure objectives? Mm-hmm. And then structure the disclosure requirement, shall disclose, we should try it. I really don't know if we are able to do that.
Cause I think,
and before we don't know that, I think we can discuss all that, but if it really works, at least I have some doubts.
Because I think this process is trying to provide the framework in order to do that. So rather than just go straight in to cut the...
Christy, you know, but I have said that from the beginning of this project, we have to test all that, at least with one or two standards, can we achieve that. Otherwise, it is good concepts, but if it is not work in practice,
Peter?
Three comments. First of all, on the objective points, I like the idea of using objectives, but I think it is difficult to do in practice, and we've had many complaints that the objectives we write are too bland and too boilerplate. And I think, to be honest, the objectives that are in here aren't a great advance on what we already have in the places where we tried it. But I was reading the paper, I was wondering whether there is a way we can develop more specific objectives, and I was thinking about what we did in the conceptual framework ED on measurement, where we said that in making measurement decisions, the board needs to think about the nature of the information that's provided. So for property, plants and equipment, if it's on the cost model, you're producing information about the cost of the property, plants and equipment you've still got and about the cost of the PPE you've consumed during the period. So maybe one way forward for this specific case would be to say that the objective is to provide information about the cost of the PPE you have at the end of the period and the cost of the PPE you've consumed during the period. It would need to be a different objective for using the fair value model. I don't know whether that works, but it might be a way of thinking about it.
But why do you provide information about the cost? Maybe the question is why information
right.
about the cost?
Right,
to determine a return on investment, to project cash flows for
right, but that's the judgment the board's already going to have to make the measurement decisions and the recognition decisions. So it might be that a similar thought process might help us think about the objectives for the disclosures as well. I don't know, I haven't really thought it through, but might be worth looking at.
Peter, I didn't quite get what you were just
saying. So for example, if the board is making a measurement decision about PPE, it would have to say, do we want to measure it at current value or at cost or something else? So the board comes to a conclusion, and let's say it's reached a decision, it's going to be cost.
Yeah.
And one of the ingredients in that decision is what kind of information is produced by a cost-based measurement. What kind of information do you get in the balance sheet? What kind of information do you get in the P&L? And so it seems to me that that might be the sort of thought process we could use for the objectives. So we're generating cost information, so we're saying we think information about the cost is useful to the investors, and so maybe the objectives should focus on the nature of the information that's being provided. Now, that's a specific example. I don't know whether we can sort of generalise that more to other cases.
I think the difficulty that we have at the moment, because we're focusing on drafting and not about content, I think what you're doing is sort of trying to link the two and sort of think about, well, what is it we're trying to achieve, which is a content kind of question. And then once you've got that clear in your mind, you can then craft objectives that link up with that. And I totally agree. And I think perhaps because we're sort of doing this in pieces, that's why it's not necessarily hanging together. But I think the idea is that ultimately it will, once the board makes some decisions and the rest of the project around the purpose and role of the notes of the financial statements, that will then drive, well, what kind of content are we looking for when we're setting disclosure requirements, and that will in turn drive what the objectives are, and therefore we might be able to do a better job of clarifying those objectives.
But otherwise I think Martin's right, we're going to find it very difficult to come up with objectives that are more specific than the ones we've already been developing, which look the same for every standard at the moment.
And does actually force you, I found, and you know, when we're trying to draft them, it does actually force you to think a lot more about what actually are we trying to achieve. And then I think it's a question we ought to be asking ourselves anyway, so that's beneficial.
This is going, the suggestion is that this goes into a discussion paper.
Mm.
I wonder if there should be more argument of the pros and cons of the approach.
I think that, that's something that certainly of Martin's points, that trade-off you have with writing something that is prescriptive and sets out these are the things you have to do, that has less judgment, essentially, because Martin's point is about the difficulty of exercising, and others have said similar things around difficulty of exercising judgment and the costs involved, and so actually we'd rather have a checklist, is essentially what you're saying, that it's easier and less costly to have a checklist versus the counter view, which is around we're trying to get more useful disclosures, so we should be asking people to do it, and where do you draw that balance? And we've got it in here a little bit, where we've talked about the two groups of disclosures are designed to get that balance, but I think maybe that's what it needs in the earlier part, is to say this is the problem we're seeking to solve, but there is the downside, and therefore some people might actually prefer a prescriptive compliance approach for that reason. So it gives a counter view, and then people can feedback what they think about that.
Could I make the other two points I was going to make, Hans? One of them is to some extent a follow-up from that. I think the order of the sort of subsections in here is consistent with what we often do, which is we start off with the accounting issues, like what's the measurement basis, what are the measurement models and things like that, and then we move on almost as an afterthought to sort of what's the nature of the thing we're looking at and disaggregation. And I wonder if we'd do better to start off with the real world things we're looking at rather than the mechanics of how the accounting works, which is a similar kind of thought, really looking forward to the nature of the information you're provided rather than the accounting process. My other point was slightly more detailed, which is, and it's really to do with boundaries of financial statements. In A12, we're talking about future changes in PPE. And it seems to me that's really a bit beyond the scope as we've set it at the moment. But the example you've given us is commitments. And I think commitments is rightly there, but it's because it's an existing commitment. It's not because it's a possible future transaction.
Stephen.
So I like the chapter, and I haven't really got any suggestions to change it. I'd be happy to put it in the DP. But my suggestion is more about one other thing we might do in the chapter and field testing. I like the fixed assets and business accommodations, and that's great. Wonder whether we shouldn't also do one more, either share-based payments or pensions, because they get such criticism. That might help. And now you've got the format and you're on a roll, I'm sure it wouldn't be too difficult to apply it to those two. You mentioned field testing, and you've asked a couple of companies to look at this. Should we, in the DP itself, invite companies to actually apply the suggestion in their response So invite them to apply one of the two or the three, if we add one more of these, to their financial statements. Send us their existing, let's say, fixed asset note. Send us the fixed asset note redone in accordance with the revised requirements. And maybe to satisfy Martin, perhaps we can give them a third opportunity, and that is to send us a note by striking through some of the disclosures in the existing checklist that they don't think is applicable. So invite them to do their own striking out, and then give us a note based upon what they think should be struck out of the existing checklist, and give them an opportunity to send three notes, or do it whichever way they choose. Then if we can get some decent responses and suggestions from companies along those lines, we can then convene a roundtable of investors and put all of this in front of them.
Together with repair.
Yeah.
Pat?
Kimberly, I want to echo what I said in April. I like the overall content and direction of where you're taking this. I want to come back and react to some comments that Martin and Peter made. But first, one of the things I think you should expand on is you use the phrase importance of information, and I think you just need to be pedantic to Martin's point. You need to explain important in terms of what? So you talk about the importance of PP&E. Why is that important? Important in terms of what? The logical consequence, I think, is to the net cash flows of the entity. That's the way I would interpret it. But I think you need to actually be specific about that. There's one thing in here that I think is missing in the notes to financial statements. This was mentioned by Steve the other day. It's mentioned in my alternative view to the conceptual framework ED. And it was touched upon several times when we did the financial statement presentation project, and that is understanding the relationship between information in the balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement. And the typical way in which that's been suggested to be communicated is through a reconciliation. You are, in fact, proposing to include as a component of additional information reconciliations. But one of the aspects or elements of that reconciliation that isn't touched on here that I suggest that you get comment on or ask feedback is understanding the differences in cash and non-cash changes. Because it's great to understand what's contributing to the beginning balance and the ending balance, but if it's all on an accrual basis, you don't really get a sense as to what actually contributed to EBITDA or operating cash flow, which at the end of the day is the holy grail. That's what these analysts are all trying to figure out. That would actually help you do that. Otherwise, what you have to do is you have to kind of guess, well, management made a judgment about obsolescence. Did that result in cash in this period, you know, outlay, or is it going to result in a cash outlay in a future period? So that kind of distinction, I think, would be incredibly valuable to get feedback on whether or not people think that's feasible here. In a multinational organization, we've always heard that this is too big a challenge, it's too daunting. But at the end of the day, I don't know how you run a business without knowing how much cash, you know, you're going to have to invest or you're going to collect in any particular asset or liability. So I want to come back to the point that Martin's making, and I think it's a critical point. It's a behavioral issue. Financial statements are viewed as legal documents. It's a compliance exercise. The typical person I'm familiar with who's actually involved in drafting notes is not the CFO. It's somebody in the financial reporting department, and many times it's the person who's got only a few years of experience. Okay, and they are using a checklist, and they're engaging with the likes of yourself and asking questions like that. So I think we are talking about a behavioral change here. There's no question that's going to need the engagement of the audit committee, the accountants, the CFO. There's no question. I don't think that this approach here precludes doing what Martin's suggesting down the road and being more prescriptive on a standard-by-standard basis. But as Christy said, this is the framework that we're thinking about for purposes of what needs to be disclosed. So The point I want to address with what Peter has made is a point that I've made many times here at this table, and I think he's spot on, which is let's start with what is the most important information as opposed to going right into the mechanics of how the numbers were calculated. That's great for, you know, the accounting geek who reads the financial statements and understands measurement and recognition principles, but it's not very helpful for somebody who's had a semester or two semesters of accounting and is just trying to get to, as I said, operating cash flow. And so I think leading with things like reconciliations, and if they had these distinctions between cash and non-cash changes, that would make their world so much more useful and productive.
Gary?
Thank you. Just several comments, most of which are builds on what was out there, and actually one new thought. First, actually, I want to disagree with what my friend Pat said about how notes are prepared. I think juniors may very well fill in numbers, but I can assure like people at CCR and stuff, it's that level you sort of sign off what's being dropped and what's being added. So I think, yeah, I agree, it wouldn't be the CFO, even though you probably at some point you're going to tell them, here's the major new disclosures you need to be aware of. But I think it's a higher level than perhaps you think in terms of the decision making about what's new and what's being dropped. Even though I agree juniors are filling it in, but I don't think they're making the central decisions.
I agree.
I do agree. I personally happen to like reconciliations or roll forwards. They tell you an awful lot. You know, now certainly accounts where it's not practical to do that. And we have the Shiller's equity table or primary statement that is basically a roll forward, you know, in many respects, and you argue the cash flow statements are roll forward too, but I think at the account element level, I think roll forwards, I think in general, tell you an awful lot of information. But as I'm looking, this thing you start wondering for disclosure objectives, is there one sort of general set of objectives when the asset or liability is perhaps more financial instrument nature, something that either can very quickly become cash or very quickly require cash, as opposed to, I'll call it static, you know, goodwill, PP&E, perhaps long-term deferred taxes that, you know, themselves don't generate taxes, don't require, don't generate cash, don't require, or expected to require, you know, need, you know, additional cash to maintain them and so on. So you start wondering, is there a way to bifurcate objectives, you know, liquid versus, you know, static accounts? I mean, as I look at, think of goodwill, and we've been talking about PP&E here, is the roll forward would tell you a lot, it would answer the question of what's happened to the accounts for the year. But goodwill, I mean, predict future cash flows from goodwill, they don't generate cash flows, and it's only M&A activity that gives you cash flows. Really, other than your recent level of activity, it really is not otherwise helpful in predicting future cash flows, because deals come and go. And I think the same thing is true, I think, of general PP&E. If you need £500 million of spending of PP&E a year, and that's your run rate, and you can see that in the multi-year roll forward, that tells you probably what you think future cash flow commitments are, absent a specific disclosure of a material new commitment or a material uncertainty. So just a way of, you know, split it, objectives, liquid versus non-liquid type balance sheet accounts. Just a thought.
Thanks. Kimberly, I like the general approach. I like the idea of the two-tier structure for the notes. Maybe on the general criteria for the, so the first part, the general principles, paragraph 26, in the factors that an entity might consider to determine whether to provide additional information, you suggest the relative importance or the amount of judgment involved. You might also maybe consider that the complexity of the transaction itself, even though there might be little judgment involved, the complexity of the transaction might require more disclosures. And maybe another factor could be local circumstances. I'm not sure that every entity in every jurisdiction will pay the same attention and give the same amount of extra disclosures, regardless of where they are. There are certain jurisdictions where certain types of
activities, transactions are more sensitive than in others. It's a matter of local culture, or maybe local requirements, by the way, which may drive an entity to provide more information. So I suggest you just add those two additional criteria, the inherent complexity of the transaction, maybe also the non-recurring nature. A transaction might be not extremely material, but it could be unusual, like restructuring or divestment, and that may in itself trigger additional information. Now, regarding the application of those principles to the different examples, let's take Appendix A, PP&E. I'm not sure whether we are not going a bit too far in the general requirements, looking at paragraph A7, little a, unless we signal that you expect the user of information to have a minimum knowledge of the business, which I think is that what we have in our framework, there is a risk that the way you phrase the objective, even though you set a broad level, to describe how the nature of the entity's business affects and determines the level or mix of its investment in PP&E. If I'm a steel mill, if I'm an oil refinery, if there isn't an assumption that the reader will know that this activity is very capital intensive, that it requires all sorts of different assets, there is a risk that people, to comply with this principle, will start writing a monography about the industry. So I think you have to add a qualifier to this notion of broad level, that assuming that the reader has a reasonable knowledge of what industry you are in. Otherwise, I think it will be counterproductive. People will start writing monographies about the industries and what it requires to refine oil or to produce steel, to introduce the description under PP&E. I don't think we need that.
Mary?
Wanted to come back to Martin's concerns about, are we doing enough to help people, and how unrealistic it is to expect a lot of judgments to be made in a short window after you've already incurred the cost of collecting the data. I mean, inherent in Martin's comments is an expectation that this is a fine-tuning that's done at the very end of this piece of data, that piece of data. And to me, I was reading this in the context of, as you map out what your disclosure requirements are going to be and therefore what data you will collect, that it occurs much earlier in the process. And I would have the hope that for many areas, the disclosure would be reasonably stable, so you don't throw out and start with a clean sheet of paper each year, and that I would hope that each year as you're planning your year in reporting process, you'd stop and think about, given the changes in operations, are there changes that have to be made? So my encouragement is that when we're talking about judgment, how you determine this, etc., that maybe talk about when in the process and planning, because I don't think I think we want to avoid the idea that it's clean sheet of paper every year, without getting too locked into it. It's always been here. So it's striking a balance.
And one comment to Mary. Maybe it is true for the big picture. I mean, if you are a bank, you don't look at disclosure for agriculture. That's clear. You can exclude that. But that is not the point, because currently also what is, I think, criticized is, okay, already if people only focusing on that, it is for banks, they have 600 pages of financial, not financial statements, but of annual report. But I think in your approach, it is quite early. I think that is not realistic, because as a company, it is potential disclosure you have to fulfill. You have to implement your reporting system, your IT system, and you cannot judge every year, okay, do I now maybe need that and change the whole reporting system? You have to do it once when a standard comes out, and then you collect the information, and then based on what you're getting back, you decide, okay, do I have to disclose it, yes or no? I think it is really no company is really every year, every second year, looking at their reporting system, do I have to change it based on our information material or not? And then if it's not material, change the whole reporting system. That is not in practice the case.
But Martin, if we amended, say, the property IF-16 to reflect this, that would be a change in standard. Do you think
as a financial institution, you may relook at your property, plant and equipment note differently if you were,
if you were presented
with this proposal.
As I said, Christy, I like it when we go to the detailed standards and really test, will that help or not. I think that is what I said earlier.
Okay.
Well, I think we had a very useful discussion. Hopefully,
can we just confirm the question, which I think is all affirmative, this on 11A.
Basically, just the question that is subject to the refinements based on the feedback that you've given us today, and we also might get some more feedback at the World Standards Centre next week as well. Subject to that feedback and those refinements, you're comfortable to include this discussion paper?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kimberly.